I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we hear an encore of our performance chat with the only African-American heart surgeon country music star you've probably ever heard of, Cleve Francis. That's coming up. But first, as Americans celebrate Independence Day weekend, the stories of the founding fathers certainly resonate. But we were curious about some of the other stories that make up the American narrative. On this Independence Day, we've brought together a group of curators and historians to offer perspectives that might be new to many. Cassie Chin is the Deputy Executive Director for the Wing Luke Museum of Asian Pacific American Experience in Seattle. Juanita Moore is the President and CEO of the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. Patty Ortiz is Executive Director of the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center in San Antonio, Texas. And Gabrielle Tayak is historian at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. And I welcome you all, and I thank you all for joining us on this holiday weekend.
It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Gabrielle, I'm going to start with you. Are there events or are there ways in which Native Americans have contributed to the founding of this country in ways that might not be universally recognized?
There are many, many myriad vast ways that Native peoples have contributed to this society since the very beginning and also since European contact. One that's very key that I think would be relevant to talking about Independence Day is that several of the founding fathers were greatly influenced by the Iroquois Confederacy, which is a group of Native nations which now straddles the border between New York and Canada. And they had and still have a form of democracy, which is a confederation, and comes from really a grassroots form of government. So rather than a hierarchical kind of organization where they make decisions by consensus. And Benjamin Franklin in particular was very much admiring of this type of form of government.
How did he know about it?
He knew about it because he was involved with different treaty negotiations and had been involved with different Iroquois chiefs. He wrote up speeches that were made by Canisatego, who was one of the Iroquois statesmen, and commented on the form of government that they had and was very much in thinking about this over time. And he brought it forward over the years into the Constitutional Convention and spoke about it, as did John Rutledge and others, talking about how there was this form of democratic organization that was not like anything that they had seen in Europe, and were looking for a particularly American brand of this. And this went into their thinking when they were crafting the U.S. Constitution.
I'm dying to know if women got a vote in there, but you can tell me that later. Whether we can pick up on that question later. Juanita Moore, what about you? Are there ways in which the African-American experience or the experience of Africans in America contributed to the formation of this country in ways that might not be universally understood?
Well, I think that because we think about this country as the premier democracy and we celebrate the liberty and freedoms of this country, I think that we always need to remember the contributions that African Americans have made to ensuring that this country lives up to that creed. And I think that the contribution that the African Americans have made is really forced Americans and America to really look at that and to deal with it from the beginning.
How long has there been, just for those who may not know this subject matter as well as you do, how long has there been an African presence in the United States?
Well, we say that 1619, but I think that if you go back to Ivan Van Sertima's, they came before Columbus. He says that there's an African presence in this country even before Columbus.
Okay, and Patty, let's go to you next. You know, we often, in the middle of heated debates, and all of us who are in the media are aware of this, but particularly I think people of Latino heritage, often it is said, you know, when some of these issues arise, I'll say, well, go back to your country. And I'd like to, and I'm thinking particularly of a friend of mine who's a columnist whose family goes back, you know, three or four, five generations here, but who still experiences this. I would like to ask you about, in 1776, what was the relationship with the southern border at that time? And how do you think the Latino presence has made itself known in this country over the course of that time?
During that time, of course, the whole area was populated by indigenous smaller groups that identified themselves and with through that Spanish inclusion into America that we became mestizos and then slowly became part of the United States. So part of our identity and is ethnicity and background of Mexico to Central America, South America, where we have a huge pride of our ethnicity. But what's interesting, I think, about the whole Chicano, Latino, Hispanic feeling is that there's a huge loyalty, I think, to our home country, to the country we were born in for the most part, meaning the United States. And so even though, you know, our forefathers, our parents came from Mexico, or we were here originally as the whole Texas area particularly, or even California became the United States, there is a belief that the United States is where we live. And so, you know, particularly this time of year, I think there's a huge pride about being part of the United States.
Now, what about in the early years of when the country was being formed as a nation? Do you mm-hmm. have any sense of how, in those early years, how mm-hmm. did that process work? Was there anxiety about that? Was there unhappiness about that? Or what is your sense of it, that history?
Again, I think it's a little bit of a struggle for us and our identity. But during those times, I think there was a slow blending of people from the North coming and connecting with people from the South. And so it wasn't, I think the conflict is more recent, I would think. And as you know, the borders have become stronger and harder, it's been a little bit more of a conflict. Mm. But I think a while back, I would say that there was just a movement back and forth. There's this obvious strong workforce in the United States that is Latino and continues to be a strong part of our economy.
Cassie, why don't you pick up the ball here? Tell us a little bit more about the history of Asians in what is now known as the United States, and how far does that history go?
Sure. I think when we think about the history of Asian Pacific Americans here in the United States, many might know about the Chinese Americans working on the railroads and helping to build the railroads, but that seems maybe more distant history, when in fact Asian Pacific Americans were here, particularly in the American West, building our cities, helping to pave the streets, working in the lumber mills and providing that wood that would then become our homes and our buildings, and working in the fishing and cannery industries as well. So Asian Pacific Americans have touched, I think, the livelihood and the settlement throughout the American West. The earliest record that we have of Asian Pacific Americans here in the U.S. comes in as early as 1587, when Filipino Americans were on Spanish trading ships landing in California. And then in the late 1700s, Filipino Americans again in Louisiana helping set up their communities. Here in the Seattle area, our first Chinese recorded immigrant was in 1865, before the city itself was incorporated. So the history is longstanding.
I do want to ask this whole question of focusing on these stories and this kind of the conversation that we are having now. Juanita, what's your take on this? Because as I'm sure you know, there are people who have called slavery the birth defect of American history, and that there are those who would argue that focusing on slavery in that era is not productive, that it just breeds a sense of kind of grievance. So I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, I think that it's important to understand that history does a number of things, that it really does helps. It helps us to remember. It helps us illuminate. It does hold up a mirror that allows us to remember and deal with things that we'd like to forget. But at the same time, Henry Hampton said, history is our rudder in the times of storm. And so I think that we can also use that to help guide us. It helps bring us together, because as I sit here and listen to these wonderful, wonderful stories, I also start to think about stories that are the counterpart stories in African-American history. Or, you know, I think about the kinds of things that these stories remind me of the conversations that we have in terms of African American studies, and in the museum, the kinds of exhibitions that we would have. I was recently at the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles, and it was the most fabulous story about the Japanese story in America, and it also the influence and the involvement in the civil rights movement in Los Angeles of Japanese people. So I started to see the similarities. It was absolutely fabulous and riveting, and I think that we all understand that It's about the traditions that bind us together, not just as a country, but as families and communities and as groups. And that's what makes a strong America. That's what we celebrate, actually, on the 4th of July. So I think this is the most appropriate time to have that conversation, because it's truly what makes America the true democracy that everybody envies, and the freedoms that we all boast about. We can hear the pride that each group has in the life that they've come to build in this country based on those things. So I think it's absolutely amazing and the best way to celebrate and talk about the 4th of July.
Gabrielle, there are those who will argue that this is not a constructive exercise, that this is the kind of thing that, while it might be nice to lift up stories that are not as well known, there are those who feel that the focus that we are placing here creates a sense of division and polarization rather than unity. And I would like to ask, as an historian, what is your take on that?
Oh, well, my take on it is what it does is it deepens what we're unified in as a project, as an American project, in the sense of where we have a country that is made up of so many different strands. And it's really delightful to be here speaking with so many different women from different ethnicities, because one of the things that's happened is that between Latino, Native American, African American, Asian Pacific American people have come together to really clarify the fact of why this is part of a part of who everybody is on this landscape. It's not really about divisions whatsoever. It's really about broadening and enriching and deepening our understanding and getting to a more accurate view of history. It's actually anti-revisionist in many ways rather than what's been called revisionist.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will talk more about key figures and events and personalities in American history that might not be as well known as they could be and should be. On this holiday Monday after the 4th of July, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll talk about another Independence Day, the 50th anniversary of the independence of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After years of foreign rule, that Independence Day was on June 30th, but we'll hear more about it in a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our discussion about new news or new narratives in the history of the United States that may not be as well known as many people would like. And we're speaking with a group of historians and curators for their insights on this topic. They are Juanita Moore, Cassie Chin, Gabrielle Tayac, and Patty Ortiz. Now I'm going to ask you to tell us about some figures whose names we may not know, but you'd like us to know. Gabrielle, why don't you start? Are there some figures from American history, from your area of expertise, that you think would be important to know?
Oh, absolutely. And you had asked me what were women's contributions. And I have a friend who is a Monacan historian, and she said, you know, I'd like to, everybody thinks about Pocahontas and Sacagawea and Squanto, and I'd like to talk about sometimes the people who were not so helpful, you know, in the sense of there's often the people who are put in the role of heroic to history, but in fact they were very much working towards helping to colonize their own areas. When you mentioned something about women, actually in the early forms of democracy, it was women who appointed the chiefs. And so the men were chiefs in the Iroquois system and still are, but the women would appoint them. And if the men don't do what the women think is proper for the health of the nation, they can impeach them.
Fancy that.
Imagine that.
We could all contemplate what we would do with that power, couldn't we, ladies?
Absolutely.
But that's good information. But are there other figures? I know a lot of people know Pocahontas.
There are so many. And not to degrade Pocahontas. I mean,
no,
there
not
were,
of course.
Certainly, you know, contributions that she had. But one of my personal favorites was a Shawnee leader named Tecumseh. And he was out in what was called the Old Northwest in the Ohio area, Michigan, and became a central figure in the War of 1812, actually on the British side against the United States. But he had a vision of creating of what he called a red state. He believed that Native people from different tribes should come together and form their own country. And his level of statesmanship, diplomacy, he was somebody who became to be embodied as what I think many even U.S. military people and other leaders saw in that early 19th century framework. So, you know, I always like to think about what would it have looked like if he had been able to have taken a proper place among other leaders.
Juanita Moore, what about you? Are there some figures or names or people who you'd like us to know more about that perhaps are not as well known?
Well, I think Ida Wells Barnett is one, as a woman who was a journalist, and she was also involved in the women's movement, voting rights activist, but she was particularly involved in really calling attention to lynching in this country. She was like a relentless voice in pushing the cause of having the leaders sort of understand the devastation of lynching. I would consider her a pivotal figure, you know, in the civil rights movement.
Patty Ortiz, what about you? Are there names of figures from history you'd like to lift up at this time that you think people would like to know more about?
Well, because I think arts and culture was so much part of our history, and it's hard to separate art and life with the Latino culture, I have to say that I draw from the artists. I would even say Judy Baca, who's a muralist in California and also worked with lower income families to help keep the pride of their culture strong. And there was a whole group in San Francisco called the Royal Chicano Air Force, who were made up of theater artists, visual artists, musicians, and they would go to the migrant camps in California to talk about health and education, and really were a strong force in helping our new families become stronger, as well as here in San Antonio, Sandra Cisneros, who's a writer, and her book, House on Mango Street, is a textbook in high school literature classes, just telling the story of our history through families and those kinds of stories.
Well, you've given us a lot to work on. We've also had an interesting conversation with Sandra Cisneros about some of the essays that she's published lately. So thank you for that. Cassie, what about mm-hmm. you? Well, give us some names, or one or two names.
Well, as I was thinking about this Independence Day, an important person to know is a man named Bhagat Singh Thind. He's actually immigrated here to Seattle in 1913, coming from the Punjab area, which is in the northern India. He came in 1913. He was 20 years old. He entered the military and served in the U.S. Army during World War II, and then he returned back to Oregon in 1920, and he applied for U.S. citizenship. And he was actually initially granted citizenship, but that citizenship was challenged. The laws said that you had to be a free white person to be able to become a U.S. citizen. So Bhagat Singh Thind challenged this ruling. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1923, unfortunately, they did rule against him. They said that U.S. citizenship was only for people who were considered, quote-unquote, white by a common man's understanding. It wasn't until many years later, after World War II, that laws changed and citizenship was opened up to Asian Pacific Americans in the 1950s. Finally, race was not a consideration for whether or not you can become a U.S. citizen. But here's this man, Bhagat Singh Thind, who took it all the way to the Supreme Court and was that one step in our ability to be able to have access to citizenship here.
Cassie Chin is the Deputy Executive Director for the Wing Luke Museum of Asian Pacific American Experience in Seattle. Gabrielle Tack is an historian at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. We were also joined by Juanita Moore, CEO of the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, and Patty Ortiz is Executive Director of the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center in San Antonio, Texas. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining me. Happy 4th, 5th. Happy Independence Day, and thank you all so much.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for including me.